To say here, I'm going to speak fairly superficially about some of the important lines of evidence against the possibility of what's technically called macroevolution. You could have said the first or a first major line of evidence was the two laws of thermodynamics. Secondly, there's this line of evidence, and there's a discussion of that in A Pandit and People, and then there's a book by Thaxton, a huge book that's very important on the matter, and that is the origin of life in terms of the theory of what's sometimes called chemical evolution or prebiotic evolution. Now, the very old theory of spontaneous generation of life, which was held by the ancient Greeks, and many people over the ages thought, well, life is sort of spontaneously generated from material, sort of like maggots out of trash. And many wanted to hold to that as an alternative to divine creation. Spontaneous generation was discredited by experiments of Francesco Redi in 1668 and by the work of Louis Pasteur in the 1860s. However, it came back in a new form. In the 1920s, a Russian scientist, A.I. Oparin, O-P-A-R-I-N, proposed that life gradually arose in a series of stages from non-living matter. Simple chemicals were alleged to have combined to form organic compounds such as DNA and so on upwards. Now, Oparin's theory is called, as I say, prebiotic evolution or chemical evolution, which is supposedly at the basis of every other kind of evolution. Oparin's theory claims support in experiments by American scientists Miller and Urey in 1953, in which they mixed simple gases together, exposed them to energy sources, and seemed to have come up with some amino acids. However, later research has clearly shown that the Miller and Urey experiment was seriously flawed as a true model of origins, because the workers, Miller and Urey and their colleagues, had to eliminate oxygen in order to produce these acids. But there is strong evidence that there has always been plenty of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere, as found in oxides and rocks. You can find the details of this in Pandas and People and other writings, which indicate that complex structures of coded information, which are essential to life, such as the DNA code, these complex structures of coded information, as in our genetic makeup, are massively more likely to be the product of intelligent design by a higher power than mere chance in a prebiotic soup in which there was oxygen and other factors that would have militated against the production of DNA without outside intervention. A third evidence against the possibility of evolution, scientifically speaking, is the whole question of genetics and evolution. Now, Darwin's theory of natural selection, in other words, something in the organism gives rise to new traits, and maybe something in the environment stimulates this thing in the organism to give rise to new traits. And these traits that are given rise to in a particular member of the species are then either preserved or weeded out by the environment. And that was based on the presupposition of the necessity of constant change within genetics. Darwin's theory is based on the necessity of constant change in genetics. However, genetic discoveries by Gregor Mendel, who was alive at the same time as Darwin but was neglected for about 40, 50 years, now it's very, very important. Genetic discoveries by Mendel, who worked with the breeding of different types of peas in Austria, his discoveries indicated strong stability within living things, not constant change. And most of us were taught, weren't we, in the 10th grade about Mendel's discoveries of how genetics work and recessive genes and dominant genes and all that sort of thing. Now, undoubtedly, there is much change within what we might call species or single interbreeding population groups. Species mutually interfertile, so probably what the Bible means by kind is a little broader than what we would strictly say species. But the change within a species, as different varieties, let's say, of dogs, is really variation within a stable gene pool. Sometimes that's called microevolution. As, for instance, the breeding of different types of cattle, animals, corn, so forth. But for the origin of new types of species or kinds, different kinds, a specific type of change would be needed, which is called macroevolution. The preponderance of all genetic evidence up to this point is against any possibility of the change of one kind or major species into another. And Mendel's work has indicated, therefore, the basic stability of the gene pools in the different kinds, that they that all the record we have, all we can do today, you still have the same kinds, not going one into the other. And for instance, I'm just hitting high points here. Take the great work that's been done for many, many years on fruit flies, bombarding them with radiation, causing mutations and so forth. And it was thought that over a period of years, with all and as rapidly as a generation reproduces in amongst fruit flies, and then getting these mutations, that you could produce new species because of fruit flies generation. We would be way, way back before Adam now, as quickly as they reproduce. But actually, they have not been able to produce another species. It's still fruit flies. So what we're finding empirically is that all the scientific work that's been done actually confirms Mendel's teaching of the stability of genetic pool and goes against Darwin's prediction that there was great change in genetic pool and that one thing could turn into another thing. A fourth line of evidence is what we might call the origin of species, closely connected to the third, and I won't discuss the detail of developments of new populations or speciation, but Pandas and People and Thaxton's book and others deal with this very well. What you have in different varieties is not macroevolution, but it's change within the basic kind. Fifthly, we have something that I think is probably one of the, has been when I was in school, certainly, and even today, the fifth line of evidence against evolution is still misinterpreted by the secular culture and used as an evidence for evolution, and that is the fossil record. Actually, one very famous fossil expert wrote about 15 years ago that the trade secret of paleontology was that the fossils actually militate against Darwinianism, but that is generally kept under wraps because it's so embarrassing. They're not the so-called missing links. They're not in the fossil record, the transition from one species into another, one kind into another. What the fossil record shows us is a sudden explosion of life. Explosion of life forms at the same time with large gaps between the different types or groups in taxonomy, such as the huge gap between invertebrates and fish. But if evolution is true, one would expect to find a vast number of transitional forms between the gaps. But the intermediate links are still missing. There is no positive evidence for evolutionary descent, rather the contrary. David Raup of University of Chicago commented in a big meeting in the early 1980s of paleontologists from around the world at Chicago University and the great Natural Science Museum there, that Darwin had said in the 1860s that the reason he couldn't give hard evidence for transition between the species, the missing links, was simply that not enough fossils had been discovered, but that Darwin said another 50 years, there'll be so many fossils discovered that it will demonstrate my theory. Dr. Raup said it's now, I believe, let's see, he said it's now 120 years since Darwin said that. And indeed, he listed how many fossils are known to exist in museums. I'm scared to say, I'd probably get it wrong, but hundreds of thousands that hadn't even had time to catalog them all. British Museum, Smithsonian, et cetera, et cetera. And he said the actual evidence goes contrary to what Darwin said. With all the massive, massive acquisition of fossils since 1860, there is still the same absence of missing links. There's still the same basic stability in the genetic kinds. And if evolution is depending on the fossils, it would be finished in any fair court of evidence, as Philip Johnson and Michael Denton both discuss. A sixth line of evidence against evolution is what's called homology, and I don't think I'll go into that very much, but there's a similar body plan amongst vertebrates, which is true. And Darwin interpreted this as an argument for evolution, that since there's a similarity in the body plan between apes and humans, let us say, that means we had a common ancestor. Of course, that's not a scientific proof. That's just a presupposition. That's just a theory he held. But actually, it's really and truly what you call in logic a circular argument. Let me quote from Pandas and People. The concept of evolutionary descent is employed to explain similar structures as the backbone of an ape, the backbone of a man, for instance. And then the existence of similar structures is cited as evidence that evolution has occurred. See what they're doing? A more likely explanation is common design, or a pattern in the mind of the infinite person who brought these structures into being, and he also wanted them to fit into the same environment for his glory. Not a common ancestor, but
intelligent design by the designer.
A seventh line of evidence against evolution is the whole question of biochemical similarities. And the argument is much the same as what we said about homology. Thaxton, who's a great scholar in biochemistry, has written this. The revolution in molecular biology provides a new way to compare organisms based on the structure of their protons and DNA. One of the important procedures of biochemical taxonomy is the determination of amino acid sequences in proteins. And without my going into the necessary details, I could refer you, for instance, to Thaxton's book or to this Pandas and People, which establishes evidence from the best work in biochemistry the last 30 years, particularly concerning the percent of difference in amino acid sequence in cytochrome C for various organisms. And as the text states, but when several similarities are put side by side, the pattern that emerges contradicts all expectations based on evolution. That's in the latest biochemical work. He also says, the data have served to support a picture of the organic world at the biochemical level, which explains all our bodies. A picture of the organic world consistent with the theory of intelligent design. That's from one of the greatest living biochemists. Let me conclude about these lines of evidence against evolution and state this. I think some of the finest and latest research in various fields of scientific endeavor, far from supporting evolutionary theory, actually show its unlikelihood, if not its impossibility. This growing field of research, thermodynamics, fossils, biochemistry, which we couldn't say proves creation exactly, but it does combine, they do combine together to indicate that belief in intelligent design, I mean, just on a scientific basis, makes far more sense of reality than any other hypothesis. I think there's more reason than ever to take a very serious and long look at what the Bible tells us about origins as being the most up-to-date thing you could find. Now, let me, however, talk a little bit about a major problem in everyone's mind when you come to deal with creation, and that is the high antiquity of the universe, which is said to have been proven by science. Well, we talked earlier about day. What about the ancient age of the world? Let me address that a little bit, and you'll understand, and I think appreciate that all I'm doing is trying to hit kind of some mountain peaks, sort of like going over all this, if not in a jet, in a biplane anyway, rather than walking through it. I think the real reason, as Dr. Cameron indicated, that some interpreters, or in fact most evangelical interpreters today, have tried to make literal day into an indefinite vast period of time is because of the widespread assumption that scientific proof, hard empirical proof, exists for a world countless millions of years old, maybe 2-3 billion. Is that true? That's the question. I mean, scientifically. Actually, the age of the earth is by no means whatsoever a proven matter in the scientific realm. Now, remember that. The last 30 years have seen a massive reassessment of evidence bearing on this question, so that the scientific community itself is now divided on how to interpret the facts of geology and astronomy and related fields. Of course, a definite majority of scientists would still strongly hold to an ancient universe. The vast majority surely do. But there is a rapidly growing body of scientific professionals, not just fundamentalist preachers, but operational scientists, highly respected in their fields, who present strong evidence to argue for a relatively young universe, which would fit into the general chronological framework of Genesis. And let me say here, I'm not wishing to suggest that if a Christian doesn't believe in a young earth, they're therefore out of the faith or a bad person, and not in the least. I know a lot of good people. That's what they think. Well, fine. But I think we have to ask, what does God say on the one hand, and what does the best scientific work indicate to be the case? Well, not only conservative Christians, but also many professionals in the scientific realm who do not hold to a biblical point of view have strongly critiqued some of the popular arguments used to prove that the world is millions rather than thousands of years old. A very helpful book to me on this question is, quote, "It's a Young Earth After All, Evidences for Recent Creation" by a man named Paul D. Ackerman, written, published by Baker Bookhouse in 1986. Let us together look at a few scientific facts which first seem to stand against the validity of ancient measurements of geological reality, and secondly, that seem to testify in favor of a young Earth. First, what's the problem with ancient measurements of reality? People say, well, everybody knows that the world is at least 2 billion years old, and you're ignorant if you don't believe that. And that intimidates Bible commentators, for instance. Let's look at that. Various chronometers, measurements, ways to measure time, have been said to prove a very ancient geological system. But many problems have been raised against the validity of these ancient time clocks or chronometers. Now, as a man, Robert Kopal, pointed out a number of years ago, there are three requirements for any valid chronometer. In other words, you know, the clock's supposed to fall back tonight, which I enjoy. I can get another hour of sleep. I love it. I hate it when it goes forward. But, you know, if your clock doesn't do reasonably well, you'll get to church at the wrong time. If you got here too early, that's better than too late, isn't it? I've done both. But for a valid chronometer, there are three requirements. One, the clock must run at a known rate. That is, nothing must happen to speed it up or slow it down. Second requirement, if this chronometer is going to be valid, whether it's a clock or whether it's a rock or a set of some structure in the physical world. Secondly, the clock must be set directly at the beginning of the time period being measured. Thirdly, the clock must not be disturbed, i.e. by the movement of the hands or whatever, during the time period being measured. Now, let us illustrate some uranium-238, which goes down to lead-206, which is said to have a half-life of 4.5 billion years. To know for certain that any particular rock containing a specific amount of uranium and or lead is so many million years old, at present, we must assume the following things, all of which are scientifically somewhat questionable. A, that the rock contained no daughter led at time zero. But it might have been created with both uranium and lead in it, and that would throw off the measurement, wouldn't it? B, you have to assume that no parent uranium or daughter lead, you know, the uranium declining into the lead, as it were, was ever added into the rock or leached out through the years. But that's questionable, because parent and daughter atoms do indeed move through rock formations by means of heating and deforming of rocks. Lead, Pb, volatilizes and escapes. Potassium, K, argon, is leached out by water. To do this is, as it were, to change the clock's hand, and thus to invalidate its supposed time measure. An example of this is found in volcanic rocks from Hawaii, which extruded underwater around 170 years ago. Yet these rocks, when measured by the potassium-argon method, gave a date of nearly 3 billion years. There's a problem with the methodology. One does well to raise questions about the proof of an ancient world. C, the rate of radioactive decay, according to this theory that the world is so ancient, the rate of radioactive decay has not varied, according to the theory, because if it varied, it would interfere with the movement of the hands. But in actual fact, neutron or cosmic radiation could have changed isotopic rates at some point in the past. An example of this is the half-life of C14, carbon-14, which is 5,730 years. The basic assumption of this method, and one man here in Virginia, I believe also at VPI, Dr. Whitelaw, has done a lot of work demonstrating the invalidity of much of this that was originally brought up by Libby a number of years ago. The basic assumption of this C14 method, there's some truth in it, but the idea is that the rate of cosmic radiation is constant. In other words, the C14 produced in the upper atmosphere is taken in by plants and animals. When they die, C14 decreases in what's left of them. And to some degree, one can measure how long something has been dead by the C14 method. Well, there's some usefulness to it, undoubtedly, but one of the problems with it is this, as Whitelaw and others have pointed out. We cannot automatically assume the constancy of the rate of cosmic radiation. Cosmic radiation affects the rate of decay. Cosmic radiation would have been at a massively higher rate at the time of the creation, and since then there's been variation of this rate because of the solar influence on Earth's magnetic field, which nobody questions being real. Probably before the time of the Great Flood, the rate of cosmic radiation would have been very different from those afterwards. Thus, the C14 method probably does have more validity after the flood than before it. But if that's the case, it cannot take us back much further than written records. And so for anything much before the flood, it's of questionable validity, according to many people who know massively more than I do about it. Now, another question that's been raised with the ancient measurement of the Earth is the theory of the slowing down of the speed of light. Let me start out by saying here that I would consider the jury still to be out on this one. And I'm not saying that I know that this is absolutely correct and proven. I'm not sure, but I have talked to several scientists. In fact, I was on the phone to one in the month of February earlier this year about this matter, who was convinced that more and more evidence going to be coming out in favor that the velocity of light has been decreasing. Just look with you at the evidence without myself wishing to be dogmatic or to know more than I know. The basic proof that the solar system is over 2 billion years old generally is based on the velocity of the speed of light, or c. And that's based, if I remember, it's not written down here, but I believe, isn't it, 299,792.458 kilometers per second. And a light year is how far it travels at that rate in a year. That's a long way. And so you can say, well, the light from such and such a star, Sirius, or what have you, is that far, and if it got to us from that far, then it, the solar system would have to be so many million years old even for the path of light to have reached us. Well, what about that? Physicists from three different countries, one of them a Bible believer and the other two presumably not, as far as I know, have independently of one another come up with evidence that the speed of light has been slowing down over the years. M.E.J. Guéry de Bray of France, who wrote in the prestigious scientific journal Science in 1927 and Nature in both 1931 and 1934, Guéry de Bray in France, Professor Troitsky of the University of St. Petersburg in Russia, who wrote a volume, Astrophysics and Space Science, in 1987, and then a Christian, Barry Setterfield of Australia, who wrote in 1983 a volume I have, The Velocity of Light and the Age of the Universe. And I read through it, although I had a lot of difficulty understanding the equations. I don't know that I bothered to go through them all, but certainly the text I could more or less follow. And these three people, De Bray of France, Troitsky of St. Petersburg, and Setterfield of Australia, have brought forth surprising evidence, which, if true, would indicate a very young solar system and would indicate that the solar system is not any older than the most conservative reading of the early chapters of Genesis would indicate, maybe 6,000 years, something like that. To state it somewhat simplistically, a scientist, according to these three scholars, who were working, by the way, independently of one another, scientists have been able to measure with accuracy the speed of light since about 1675, when it was measured by an astronomer, Danish astronomer named Reimer. There were later measurements believed to be essentially accurate of the speed of light by an English astronomer, Bradley, in 1728. And after that, many, many other measurements of the velocity of light down to 1960, when the speed of light seems to have reached a constant rate. However, what's later been understood is that since 1960, we've measured the speed of light by atomic clocks. But if the speed of light is truly decreasing, then the atomic clocks would also be slowing down. Now, but without worrying about atomic clocks at present, let's just note that these three different physicists, astrophysicists, noted that there was a slowing down of the velocity of light between 1675 and 1728. And from 1728 to Michelson and Morley from California in the early 20s and so forth and so on. Well, scientists were able to grasp the rate of the decrease in the speed of light. It was a log sine curve, to those of you that work with a little bit with mathematics. And thus they could extrapolate backward this information of the rate of decrease between these various years. It was found that at the time of creation, as we Christians would certainly call it, light would have been traveling 5 × 10⁻¹⁰ faster than now. In other words, that's more than 7 million times faster than now. Light was traveling, if these men's research is right. This works out an age of the solar system of approximately 6,000 years. Interestingly enough, just the amount of time that's indicated by the genealogies of Genesis. In other words, if indeed C, speed of light, slowed down, and one is measuring the universe in terms of the time it takes light from the stars to reach Earth, then the universe is much younger than on the assumption of the relative slowness of the velocity of light. That would be something like it, assuming it took a jet as long to get from Atlanta to New York as it would a man who was backpacking. Your measurements would be wrong if you measure the jet by the backpacking time. But there's more to the slowing down of the speed of light than that, more significant in these chronometers or these so-called clocks. All chronometers in the universe are dependent on the speed of light for their validity in measuring the passage of time. This is because the velocity of an electron in orbit around the proton of an atom is directly proportional to the speed of light. Hence, the speed of light has been slowing down, according to these scholars, so that light years indicate an age far too great if we measure them by the speed of light now, which is massively slower than it was. Well, if that's the case, then other physical atomic clocks have also been slowing down and indicate an age too great. In other words, the radioactivity is directly proportional to the speed of light. You know, propulsion of mass energy. It's all one. And if one's been slowing down, the other's been slowing down. Now, again, I would say I don't have time to go into it, but I'm aware of the critique of the slowing down in the speed of light and the answers that are being given to confirm it. I would assume that the jury is still out on it and will be very interested to see what turns out in another 10 years. By the way, Stanford University, again, not a, as far as I know, a fundamentalist institution, Stanford University near San Francisco held a symposium on Barry Satterfield's work in the late 1980s. And published it, which I have, and there's a growing interest in this thing, and it's controversial, as you can imagine. It would be. Another person that I really do not want to take time to go into, Dr. Russell Humphreys, seems to be a very reputable scientist, has recently written a book entitled Starlight and Time, arguing that gravity affects the working of clocks, as, for instance, the clock which is at Greenwich Mean Time in England near London, ticks a few microseconds per year more slowly than the one in Boulder, Colorado, which is a much higher elevation. So gravity affects clocks, and He believes in the creation of the universe, the massive gravitational things that were happening. You couldn't get the true reading in light years should be in thousands, not hundreds of millions of years. And he's obviously interested in going into that. It's a book entitled Starlight and Time, Solving the Puzzle of Distant Starlight in a Young Universe, published in 1994. And I really don't know enough about general relativity and special relativity to feel that I could comment on the validity of Humphrey's work. But maybe there's something to it. Let me just mention, I can see the time's going, so I don't have time to discuss it really, but let me mention some of the hard empirical facts which seem to speak in favor of a young Earth or solar system. What we've done the last several minutes is to look at arguments against the high antiquity of the universe by saying, but the way they measure it is questionable. Now let's see, there are other ways to measure the age of geological and physical structures. Ways that seem to indicate a young Earth in terms of thousands, not millions of years. What are some of these ways? And I can only mention them to you. One is human population. Henry and Morris has worked that out in various writings, and others have done research on it, that that the human race couldn't be much more than about 6,000 years old because of rates of reproduction, even including wars and famines and that. That if the world were millions of years old, there wouldn't be standing room between the Earth and the Moon. And that's they've worked out in all the equations. Secondly, the formation of river deltas, such as the Nile in Egypt or the delta of the Mississippi. It's been worked out by hydrological engineers who know such things as indicating a young Earth. Gas in porous rocks. A lot of work has been done on this. A particular scholar the field of oil research in Louisiana, the gas wells in Louisiana, indicating that the pressure there still is in gas and oil because that can eventually leach out, indicates a very young Earth. Others have measured the salinity of the oceans, chemical composition of the oceans, indicating not an ancient Earth, but a young one. The Poynting-Robertson effect on comets, which I won't go into, be a bit complicated, indicates the fact that the comets haven't decomposed, and they are decomposing, indicates they hadn't been there as long as millions or even billions of years would require. They wouldn't even be there. The whole question of dust on the moon was certainly an interesting one. You know how, and Dr. Walter T. Brown has got because later the evolutionists denied they'd said it, and he's published what they were writing in the 50s, that because of the antiquity of the moon, maybe 2 billion years old, that there might be 20, 30 feet of dust on the moon since it was so old because of the cosmic dust that would settle on the moon. And so the American astronauts were Armstrong and those were concerned when he stepped on the moon lest he would sink down into many, many feet of this cosmic dust. And so the module was up on legs so he wouldn't suffocate. But actually, when he got to the moon, there wasn't but an inch or two or three of dust, indicating the moon would be more likely thousands of years, certainly not millions. Well, I must make this point briefly, as I'm sort of moving from just the different kinds of evidence against an ancient Earth, against evolution, and in favor of a young one, and in favor of creation. Let's think a minute, as we come closer to closing, about the starting point in assessing evidences. The starting point in assessing evidences. This is very, very important. And I know that some of the things I've said this morning are probably hard to follow. and I apologize for that, but I believe you can follow this one. Not only famous Reformed theologians like Cornelius Van Til, but also scholars of clear mind in the field of legal evidences like Philip Johnson of Berkeley, whom we've mentioned, have both shown from very different fields that there is an inescapable sense when you're dealing with evidence that faith determines fact. Faith determines what you will accept as a fact. Van Til says that many years later in a different field. Johnson says it. In so many words, that is one's starting point or presuppositional framework, or with the historian of science Thomas S. Kuhn, as he says in his Structure of Scientific Revolutions, one's paradigm tends to blind one to even empirical facts which do not fit the perceived framework. But if you don't, it doesn't fit into your framework, you tend to discount it as being an acceptable fact to be discussed, which is, I think, one of the problems with some of the media. They just don't even see. How many did they see the Republicans taking the House and the Senate in 1994 before it came? No. Now, Christians have long been accused of the blinding, obscurantist point of faith. A lot of scientists said, you Christians are bad news. You might be nice people, but you're in bad shape because you start out with faith. It makes you biased. I mean, it's very sad how our young people are often intimidated in college and university, made fun of for that. But today, both legal studies and operational scientific research combine to demonstrate that evolution is the supreme faith. It's a religion. Hence, Philip Johnson, evolution is dogma. It's a faith. It's a protected dogma in the schools. I know of a man that was fired from a university in California because he was converted and changed his views from evolution to creation. He lost his job. Here's what Philip Johnson says in Evolution is Dogma. What the science educators propose to teach us is evolution and label as fact. It's based not upon any incontrovertible empirical evidence, but upon a highly controversial philosophical presupposition. That's Philip Johnson. It's not scientific evidence, it's a philosophical presupposition. In a more recent volume, Johnson discussed the astonishing lecture of Dr. Colin Patterson, who is the senior paleontologist of the British Natural History Museum, given at the American Museum of Natural History in 1981. And Dr. Patterson said in his lecture, he compares creationism with evolution. And he characterized both creationism and evolution as scientifically vacuous concepts which are held primarily on the basis of faith. I'm giving Johnson's words exactly. According to Patterson, Darwin's theory of natural selection is under fire, and scientists are no longer sure of its general validity. Evolutionists increasingly talk like creationists, says Johnson, in that they point to what they wish to be a fact, but cannot provide an explanation of the means that it got there. I want to say this, and I know I've got to close here in a minute, that in talking to people that may not agree with you, of course we always want to speak in charity and in some humility, but not apologetically when God says it. In talking to people, particularly our young folks, high school and college, I've said this to my own dear children, you show them that they're operating on the basis of faith. The humanist, the quote liberal, The secularist, the materialist, the evolutionist. Say, oh, but you're operating on the basis of religion. They'll get angry, maybe. Or what? That's ridiculous. They know you have a system by which you're looking at life and it structures reality that assumes certain things that you can't prove. So it's a religion. Let me tell you about mine. You tell me about yours. I'll listen. Then either you tell me first, I'll listen to you, or let me tell you first and I'll listen to you. Let's see which of these faiths, which of these religions seems to be the best grounded in what we can gather from what is around us. Well, I believe, beloved friends, as I'm closing out here, that we might be at a very encouraging time. I started out by talking about how the 20th century has declined. Yes, it's true, but remember this, with every crisis there's always a great opportunity. We're in a time of transition. Liberal evolutionism has peaked. It's probably breaking down if the truth is known. It's more and more clear in today's world the difference between a biblical Christian worldview and a humanistic Christian worldview. Humanistic anti-Christian worldview. Evidence is coming from surprising quarters against the basic foundation of secular humanism, against evolution. Although the theologians have been the last to appreciate it, don't look to them for any help. I think we might be on the verge of what Thomas S. Kuhn of University of Chicago in 1970 called a paradigm shift. We're going to be debating these matters, slowing down the speed of light, all these kind of things. Do not let the evolutionary people intimidate you, make fun of you for believing Genesis. The last laugh may be on them. I think we're in a time of transition. I don't know how long this time of transition will last. Will it last 30 years? Will it last 50 years? Will it last 100 years? I've got no way to know. But I believe, I don't think it'll be 100 years, actually. Things are happening so fast. I believe we're in a transition of two presuppositional sets of viewing the world, or two models for seeing life, two sets of spectacles, glasses as it were. One secular humanism based on evolution, the other biblical Christianity based on creation out of nothing. And so many problems are being raised against the very mechanics of evolution. As this keeps on, I believe their whole framework may collapse. Kind of like nobody thought USSR could ever collapse. And it did. Very fast. Nobody predicted it. I believe evolutionism may, I'm not saying I know it, because I don't know it, but I'm just believing it may be supplanted. Probably won't be in my lifetime. Maybe in my children's lifetime. Maybe in my grandchildren's lifetime. Whenever I have grandchildren. It may be supplanted by a more biblically based view of creation. I hope it will, because I want the Lord Jesus Christ to get the praise for what he did. I'm concerned about this not because I'm a narrow literalist or a ultra this or ultra that, just because I love the Lord Jesus Christ. I believe God's word. And my first concern is the first phrase in the Lord's Prayer, first petition, "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." I want God's name hallowed in the land. Our country and our Western society is not going to be turned around, not going to be saved, not going to be made whole until we turn to the foundational teaching that God created all things to the honor and the glory of his Son, to whom be the praise forever and ever. Amen. Well, I think we're going to have some time now for questions and answers, and I'll do the best I can.